welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. I have a great show for all of you today. Katie Franklin will be joining me. She is the operations director at ReFed, which is the national nonprofit working to end food loss and waste. And I'll be telling you more about her when she comes on in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some exciting things going on in the news, some sad things going on in the news, and of course, share my weekly recipe with all of you. First off, I'm sure we all are watching the news and seeing the devastation that is taking place in Kentucky and other areas that were devastated by the tornado. And, these natural disasters are going to keep happening more and more as we deal with climate change. And, other than cutting our greenhouse gas emissions and really trying to turn this around, right now we really have to just learn to deal with these devastating weather eruptions that are happening. And so I did share a link on my newsletter, a place where you can donate to some of the relief funds that are going on. And the New York Times actually posted a whole list of places, and I linked to that as well on my newsletter. So if you feel moved to help some of the people really dealing with the disaster that just happened, I think 25,000 people are still without electricity. Hundreds of people lost their homes. A 100 people or so were killed. 100 were still missing, last that I read. So it's really such a sad situation. So put them in your prayers, send a little love, and if you can, send a little money to help the relief fund. Other ways you can take action this week. I'm asking you to ask your senators to provide funding for the Build Back Better Act, which actually has a lot of money in there, $28 billion, as a matter of fact, to help fund programs that will benefit farmers and ranchers. They will help promote conservation practices and permanently protect farmland from development. As you know, once farmland gets developed, there's no turning back. It's gone forever. So, and we really need to really support farmers. Right now, last week when I had my guest on from the American Farmland Trust, Samantha Levy, we talked about how the majority of the farmers in this country are 65 years or older, and 92% of them do not have a second generation or third generation person to take over their farm. So for many of these farmers, selling out is the way to go. That's their retirement fund. And we can't afford to lose this land to farming. So do support that. Also, I have a petition to stop National Grid from building frack gas vaporizers in Brooklyn. For years, we've been fighting the Williams pipeline, which they wanted to build in Brooklyn. And that was supposedly permanently denied. However, now they're still trying to make money off of the fracked gas, and that's through these vaporizers, which also, of course, can leak, and they're in marginalized communities. And we just want to say no to any infrastructure that has to do with the gas and oil industry. We really need to be moving and transitioning our whole country to these renewable sources, and putting more money into that is not the way to go. It's only good for those companies and their shareholders, and putting profit over people is not what we want to support. So please sign that petition as well. And lastly, I want to share with you that I am still doing my coat drive. Unfortunately, the River Fund New York, which is the organization I had partnered with for the past 25 years, is no longer accepting used coats and winter clothing, nor are they serving any cooked food. So my partnership with them came to an abrupt end during COVID. But I did find another organization that they connected me with, which is the JCC A, which is the Repair the World Child by Child organization in Brooklyn. Wonderful Jewish organization that's really putting these clothes out into the community and along with these gifts. So what I am doing, I am continuing my coat drive, where you can bring any winter coats or sweaters or blankets, anything to help keep people warm to my home in Old Westbury as a drop-off. You can also connect directly with the JCCA. And if you need that link and Brooklyn, dropping off in Brooklyn is easier for you, let me know and I'll send you a contact there where you can drop it off in Brooklyn. But I'm also continuing collecting jewelry. It's a win-win for so many people. As a woman, I know how much jewelry I have in my closet or jewelry box that I don't wear. And, you know, as a woman, I am constantly being given beautiful gifts of new earrings and new necklaces and bracelets. And I only have one neck and one set of ears, and there's only so many earrings I can wear. So when you're ready to retire one of your old pairs of earrings, polish them up, put them in a box, and we will make them available to people to give as gifts to their loved ones. And it's really great because there's so many toy drives that go on this time of year. And so the little kids are certainly covered. But what about the older girls who don't want a toy? You know, getting a pair of earrings or a nice pair of jewelry is really wonderful. So I do have someone who donates a case of beautiful jewelry boxes to me every year. So I polish up the jewelry and put them into little boxes, and we will share them. So if you have any jewelry you'd like to donate, please, please send them my way. And now I want to share with you my recipe. This week I made a cream of cauliflower potato soup. And I have for years made this potato leek soup that everybody loves. And I've added cauliflower, which just makes it a little bit lighter, not quite as heavy, but equally delicious. So you're going to start with two medium leeks. You chop them. I use a little bit of the green part as well as the white. But mostly you're using the white part of the leeks. Two shallots that I diced up and four scallions and chop those. And if you don't have scallions, you can use a regular onion. One onion would be equivalent of the four scallions. Some olive oil just to coat the bottom of your pan. One head of cauliflower that you're going to cut up into little florets. Four potatoes that I scrubbed. I did not peel my potatoes. I leave the peel on, but if there's any dark brown spots, I cut those off. And then I cut it up into little cubes, about a half inch square. 8 cups of stock. Now, I found this great umami powder to turn my water into this beautiful stock. You can use a bouillon cube. You can start with a vegetable stock that you've made or one that you've bought, or you can even just use water if you don't have a stock. But having a stock actually just deepens the flavor and makes it that much more delicious. 1 package of fresh tarragon, or actually if it's in season, you can cut it from your garden, or 2 tablespoons of dried tarragon. And you can actually have more to taste, you know, depending on how old your tarragon is. I found sometimes I have to add so much tarragon because my tarragon, you know, was bought years ago, so it had lost some flavor. So it really depends. You know, spices don't really go bad, but they do lose some of their potency. So if your spices are old, you just need to use a little bit more. And then I also had a tablespoon of chopped parsley that I put in, and I saved a little bit for garnish on the side. And then, of course, salt and pepper to taste. So you're going to heat your large pot with a little bit of oil on the bottom. I actually used my Instapot for this just so that it would be off the stove and I didn't have to worry about it so much. I added the leeks, the scallions, and the shallots to the pot and simmer those. I covered them and let them just simmer on low till they really got soft and fragrant. Just keep stirring frequently so that it doesn't stick to the bottom. Then I added the cauliflower and the potatoes. Again, I stirred that up so that it was coated with some of the oil and let that cook slowly until the potatoes start getting soft. And the potatoes tend to stick to the bottom of the pan. So when that happens, just add a tablespoon of water at a time. That will release the stickiness on the bottom of the pan and allow it to continue to saute. And do that until the potatoes are soft, about 10 minutes. Add your stock to that. And I like to, you know, I boil my water in my tea kettle, and then I make the stock in a measuring cup, mix it with the packet of the umami, and then added that. By adding boiling water, you're just saving a little time, but you certainly can add cold stock if you want, and then bring it to a boil and then reduce the temperature. But I was adding already boiling water, so I just added it, put it down to low, and let that simmer for, you know, 20 minutes or so altogether. Add the tarragon, the salt and pepper to that, and the parsley, and let it cook. Like I said, 10, 20 minutes. You can't really overcook it. Then you're going to use an immersion blender to puree the soup. And if you don't have an immersion blender, it is really a worthwhile investment. They are not expensive, and they are a tool. I remember the days of, you know, scooping out my soup and putting, you know, cupfuls into the food processor and then putting it back into the pot. And oh, what a mess it made. This is just so easy and it's wonderful. And you can have cream soups all winter long. So enjoy that. And now it is my pleasure to introduce to all of you, Katie Franklin. She is the operations director at ReFed, which is a national nonprofit working to end food loss and waste by advancing data-driven solutions to help businesses, funders, innovators, policymakers, and more address the problem of food waste. She supports ReFed's organizational development and strategy and designs systems for effective program implementation and management. Previously, Katie managed operations at Sustainable America, where she gained a deep understanding of successful food waste reduction programs with customers, food service providers, private firms, and at major events. Katie has authored industry and academic research on food waste and opportunities to solve this global challenge. Katie also helped develop Further with Food, a public-private partnership convened to address food loss and waste. During the holiday season, while so many people are struggling with food insecurity, it's really great to know there's people out there working to try to reduce food waste and this problem of food insecurity. So, Katie, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Bhavani. It's a pleasure to be here today, especially as you said, it's such an important time thinking about food and all the connections that we have to it. So, really happy to be here.
Absolutely. So I thought maybe you could start. I always like to start asking my guests to just share a little bit of your own personal history. Like, how did you come to work in the food realm? Did you always know that you wanted to work with food? And how did it kind of lead you towards food waste?
Yeah, so absolutely not. It's not what I thought I was going to do. So happy to share that journey. I actually studied political science in school and was really motivated more so by the human rights work that I was able to kind of research and get engaged in when I was in university. And then from a functional perspective, I had a background in kind of finance, accounting, commercial real estate development. And I, you know, graduated from school, was working in those fields. And I think it was just serendipitous that all of that kind of came together. And I knew that I'd be happy in something in a social impact space or an environmental impact space. And I found Sustainable America, this really wonderful organization that actually brought me from Texas up here to the East Coast about 7 years ago now.
And are you from Texas or is that where you went to school?
I am from Texas originally. Went to school there as well, but I came to the East Coast once very briefly to look at apartments and then moved my whole life up here.
Wow.
And it was a definitely a very difficult first winter, not knowing what snow was really as a native Texan. So I'm still learning about layering and all of those good things. It's a work in progress. But in any case, I found this really wonderful organization, Sustainable America, that was working on food and fuel sustainability. So really looking at kind of that intersection of how those two markets work. And one of the areas that we worked on was food waste. We were also looking at like alternative growing. And then same on the fuel side, we were looking at fuel waste, so like engine idling, as well as alternative fuels, electric vehicles, things like that. But food waste ended up being an area that there was just a lot of traction around. People were starting to inquire about it more. They were starting to get really intrigued by the vast solutions towards it. And we were also realizing that this is an immensely solvable problem. And unlike some of the other kind of issue topics we were working on, like electric vehicles, for instance, it lacked the kind of like political tensions, if you will, that you can get with some other topics in those spaces. And food waste is a topic where nobody wants it. It's very easy, whether you're talking politics or, you know, just different viewpoints, like nobody is like, yes, I would like more food waste, please. Right. Except for the plants and the ants, and the pigs and stuff. And so really kind of honed in on food waste there. That was where I was really fortunate enough to do that research that I embarked on, both on the academic and industry side. Got to write some impact investing research, did a little bit more work in impact investing, also got to write some work for the Fuel Up to Play 60 program.
What program is that?
Fuel Up to Play 60, which is actually a collaboration between NFL and a vast number of schools where they're working on with students in schools to get them to spend 60 minutes outside every day. And they put together these really fun playbooks for the students on topics like food waste is one, but just healthy eating. Not going to remember the others, but it might actually be a really nice intersection with a lot of the topics that you cover. But getting students to think about these kind of higher level topics that are really present in their day to day and how they can take action. So it really empowers students to take kind of leadership positions in their schools, be engaging their administration, their parents. So that was a really fun project to work on. And then that all led me to ReFed, where now I get to spend, 100% of my time focusing on this topic of food waste and bringing my operational skills plus kind of this, dabbling in kind of the programmatic work that I've gotten to do and just bring all of that to helping to grow and build ReFed. We're a very young organization still. We only started in 2015. So definitely still growing, definitely still figuring out exactly what the right programming is for us. It's been fantastic getting to be part of that, and we're still working on it. We're still growing and figuring out exactly where we're going with certain things. That is where I've been in a nutshell, and wouldn't change it for the world.
Well, just quickly perusing the ReFed website, and looking at stats, it's just amazing. When you realize that, you could invest $14 billion and have a return of $73 billion in financial gain by doing something good, right? It's just amazing. But how much food waste there is. I mean, on your website, you say 35%, but I've heard it's as high as 40%. So I think it's a really hard thing to actually measure, but either way, it's pretty bad. And it's, responsible for a good percentage of our greenhouse gas emissions. It's just, like you said, it's a win-win. There's no one that says, yes, I want food waste. So, let's talk a little bit about ReFed and your position there and some of the stats that are up here on your website that are just so shocking.
Sure. So my role is really behind the scenes and operations. So I think of my work as getting to help enable all of the amazing programs that the team puts forward, the real mission-based work. So my work for those reasons is less exciting to talk about unless you want to have a conversation about financial reporting. So I'll talk more about what my colleagues were doing.
Okay.
But they're working really across kind of three main verticals of work. So the first one is the data and insights, and you're really talking about some of that right now. So ReFed was born out of a report. In 2016, we were not an organization. We were kind of barely an idea, but we really were a report. Our founder, Jesse Fink, and his wife, Betsy, they had a farm up in Milford, Connecticut, and they were personally seeing some of the food that they produced come back.
You froze.
Oh, sorry about that. Okay, I can repeat that piece. Our founder, Jesse Fink, and his wife, Betsy, they had a farm up in Milford, Connecticut, and they personally saw some of the food that they were producing coming back into their compost, but not in kind of like, really small trimmings or just, coffee grounds and that kind of stuff, but in the form of food waste. And they asked themselves, like, is this a personal issue? Like, are we doing something wrong or is this a bigger issue? And so they kind of took a step back and said, well, we could look at this from a kind of a regional food shed here in kind of the Connecticut tri-state area, or we could look at this nationally because there's a good chance this is something bigger. And they're big thinkers. They're catalytic. They like to, move. They like to change the world. And so they brought a bunch of other funders and folks from across the food system and co-created this report, which that was ReFed. When we first started, we were just a little, stack of papers bound together that looked nice. And then out of that report, everyone who was involved in that and co-created it, got to feel like they were part of that, said, there's a space for someone like maybe a ReFed to bring people together in this unique way, like you did with this research, to drive action and to make some real things happen. You already did this with the report. You brought people together that were never talking before. You got data and insights together in a way that's never been done before. What could we actually do if we took that a step further and we were talking about, action? And, what would this look like if we picked a problem like standardized date labeling and we actually worked on that together under the ReFed umbrella? And that's exactly what we did. We started with date labeling. We brought people together, in a room, so to speak, and we had FDA, we had Campbell's, we had Harvard Food Law and Policy Clinic, and a multitude of other players around the table, and working with the meat industry and getting everyone on board to say, we are comfortable with a two-label system and agreeing how we're going to decide which products get which labels. And this is moving away from a pretty archaic system that has about 30 different labels that are incredibly confusing for the manufacturers, for the retailers, for us as consumers. And it's one of the most cost-effective solutions that we could be working on. Yeah. It's going to involve still a pretty long timeline of transition over to the two-label system. And then we've got consumer education, because you can't just put labels out and expect people to be like, oh, yes, I know what that means now. Mm-hmm. That's one example of a problem that we saw no one was working on or able to work on successfully alone. And we said, all right, guys, we're going to get together and we're going to do this.
Yeah. Well, so, like I said, when I was talking about my recipe, my tarragon, because I also did catering, cook commercially, I bought a big size of dried tarragon, and there's no way I could use that up in a year.
Yep.
But I'm not going to just throw it out. And I remember being shocked. I did some private chefing for wealthy clients. And I remember coming in one day and they had their housekeeper literally go through all of their cabinets, and anything that was post-dated was in the garbage. I mean, yeah. All their spices, the spices that I needed, were gone. Everything was just thrown out, brownie mix, packages of, stuff that doesn't go bad. You know, exactly. It just doesn't go bad. It's packaged and fun. It, you know, like, it's just crazy. And so these dates, you know, was just, you know, is amazing to really change that. And so tell me, was it changed? What is the new?
It's in process. So we have seen some progress made. So for instance, like Walmart and General Mills have made progress, in particular, like on their white label products. What we've found is that folks usually aren't willing to make a whole packaging change just to change that. So they'll incorporate into normal packaging change cycles. What was, and you know, kind of like you were, I've heard in some of your other talks, you know, this pandemic has interrupted so many things for us. You know, even before the pandemic, we had interruptions with date labeling because there were changes to nutrition guidelines, bringing in, moving from full servings to adding in, you were bringing, having a serving column, but then also if you eat the full container, like, you know, I do most of the time.
Right. like so most people do that. Most of the time, right?
Yes, like most of us do. So, and so then we also had packaging suppliers saying like, we're not going to do 3 packaging runs this year for each of these tiny things. That's not feasible. That's going to lead to more food waste, actually. We need to consolidate these. So there have been hiccups, but we have actually seen, whether it's Kirkland or Kirkland products within the Costco family, or Walmart's private label, or General Mills' private label, those private labels that they have a little more control over and can do faster runs with, we've seen progress there. And so it's going, but it's definitely got a long tail, lots of commitments, which we see a lot, of course, and definitely a lot of energy, and it's progress, not perfection yet. Okay. And so that's one example of a place where we've been able to kind of bring people forward, really leveraging that data. And it was awesome to hear, for instance, that with that roadmap, we actually heard stories of, you know, whether it was a big food company or investors or foundations, they actually were, you know, sitting around their board tables and, you know, they'd get their roadmap out. This is just a kind of some printed versions, but they would actually sit down and say like, okay, the roadmap says this, what 2 things are we going to be working on out of this roadmap? And they actually were using that document. And now they're using our more recent one that we released to really guide strategy. And it's amazing to see those tools actually being used and to know that, you know, we did at least a good enough job on the data analysis. It's absolutely not perfect. You know, any type of data work is, you know, you got to be transparent about your data quality, of course, but it's amazing just to hear those anecdotes. We were using the roadmap in our strategy session at our board meeting today, and we've decided to move forward with these 3 solutions. And where do we go from here? That's a lot of the conversations that we get to have. And then that actually moves into our next vertical of work, which is capital and innovation. And that's where we work with a lot of investors, foundations, even public funding sources, as well as the solution providers themselves, whether that's entrepreneurs just getting started or folks who have been around for, you know, several decades longer than ReFed. And they're there to provide those solutions. And we have over 900 solution providers that we track, that we're regularly hearing from in terms of their funding needs, in terms of their partnership needs. And we do a ton of network facilitation, matchmaking, and really elevating those opportunities for people to get involved, for money to flow. You know, you're talking about some great donation opportunities before. We recognize that money has to be in the picture for these things to happen. Mm-hmm. And so that's immensely critical for us. And as you pointed out, there's a 5-to-1 return on the right. investment. Right. And so there's real tangible benefits. There's certainly concessionary capital needed, whether it's grants or even if you think about tax subsidies on the public funding side and government funding side. So it's not all going to be financial returns, you know, all across the board. But there will be. We have our first unicorns in the space, companies valued at over $1 billion, which is really exciting. It's a nice milestone, and it also kind of elevates food waste and those solutions into a space where you're really only seeing, you know, really flashy tech companies, which kind of puts this topic into a different kind of community of people who might be engaged and willing to offer their technology, their knowledge, their connections, their networks, which is pretty fantastic. So that's like a Google or a Salesforce, bringing that type of infrastructure into food waste, and whether that's making donations connected in real time so that perishables are getting donated, and that we're moving away from more just shelf stable products and into more nutrient dense, high quality, you know, vegetables, fruits, proteins, and culturally appropriate products. Like, that's a big deal. And then we also do a great amount of work just in stakeholder engagement. So I've mentioned, you know, working with all of these different types of stakeholders, but we do a lot of network facilitation. We launched a Food Waste Action Network earlier this year that has about 550 members from every corner of the food system, policy, other NGOs, local, national, regional, investors, entrepreneurs, academia, I'm probably forgetting some folks, but they're all like actually working together, and just by signing up, they've already indicated like, I'm here and I want to show up and I want to do something, which is amazing. There's so much energy. There's so much passion in the sector. And that's one of the best things about coming to work every day.
I think one thing I think a lot of people don't understand when you talk about food waste, you're not only talking about the actual food, you're also talking about all the resources that went into growing that food, transporting that food. You know, there's so many different aspects that are wasted. I mean, the amount of water that's wasted to water all those crops that get wasted, you know, that's, you know, when you talk about the data research, those are the kind of things that are so hard to quantify and to really understand. That it's not just, you know, throwing out that avocado, especially an avocado that takes so much water. You know, it's not just the avocado, it's everything else.
Absolutely. So we, you know, from our kind of analysis and estimates, and to your point, it's very hard to get truly accurate information on this because it's so complex, it's so diverse, and that avocado is very different from a tomato, and that tomato grown in Florida is very different from a tomato grown in California. And it's very different depending on where it goes and how long it takes to get there. But we estimate that the impact of uneaten food is 4% of our greenhouse gas emissions, which 4 sounds like a small number, but that is significant. 4% of our greenhouse gas emissions is also equivalent to about 20% of the cars on our road. So there's a pretty significant comparison there to, if we reduce that, we could really be impacting some changes in our climate. It's about 14% of all fresh water use. This is, again, immensely critical as we've been facing droughts in the West. We're going to continue to see that as climate risks really exacerbate how our growing systems change. We're seeing kind of the bands of our growing regions increasingly move up in the Northeast. And so water use is going to be really critical. We are seeing some interesting innovations and in things like indoor growing, vertical growing, whether it's kind of like aquaponics or different types of systems that could be more efficient. But the reality is we're still going to be growing on farmland in the vast majority of our food. And we need to be thinking about how, when we're throwing away that avocado or those almonds or those chickpeas, there's so much water embedded in them.
Right.
We're also using 18% of all cropland, which is pretty significant. And that's an interesting one because if we think about, and granted, I don't know if we have time to think about long-term climate effects anymore, but if we think about the long-term climate effects, land use change is a very significant driver of climate change. So that's another way that the climate story really interacts with food waste. And then lastly, it's also almost a quarter of our landfill inputs. Food waste is in most nationally and in almost every region as well, on a state level, the largest single source material in our landfills, which is absolutely bonkers. We have plenty of other things to throw away, I'm sure. And just like you were, I was listening to your talk with American Farmland Trust, and you're talking about methane. Methane is a short-lived climate pollutant. It's, you know, about 27 times as potent as other carbon emissions. And that's what is released from our landfills when food rots in it. Because the food, it gets crushed in there, it breaks down in certain oxygen-limited processes, and then it releases methane. And methane is what you're hearing about probably right now with the Arctic stories going on, with that current that's going around the Arctic right now. And it was really exciting to hear the methane pledge out of COP. It, you know, we'll see where that goes. But that was really exciting to hear. And then something else that is probably worth noting is there's also impacts on things like fertilizer. I know there's been some really interesting news stories lately about the really dramatic increases in fertilizer pricing. It's been more related to urea as opposed to like phosphorus. But phosphorus is a non-renewable resource. You know, eventually we will run out of the inputs that we currently use for our fertilizer products, and we're going to have to figure out something different. And interestingly enough, food waste solutions could help with that, because food waste solutions, if you think about it from like a circularity perspective, could be producing the compost or the nutrient additives back into our soil. You know, we could be thinking about more regenerative practices that really all come together through this.
So, yeah, Katie, how successful are the compost programs that are being set up? Like, I know New York City had one, then they aborted for a little while, and it's coming back. How successful are the compost programs, and are they helping? Where is that compost taken?
Yeah, so it really varies. I know, like you said, New York has had a little bit of a stop start. Some cities have done better than others. I want to say like Massachusetts is a pretty successful example. I know Austin has had some decent success with their programs. Some neighborhoods in kind of the Bay Area in California. I'm certainly only hitting some of the more commonly called out ones, but it really varies, and you often see it succeeding in pockets of cities as opposed to citywide, which is even what we had here or have had here in New York City with the rollouts. Like, for instance, I'm over in Queens, and for whatever reason, whatever road I've lived on, I've just happened to be like out of range for like community composting or curbside composting. So I've been like eagerly waiting for my brown bin, and I have never gotten one. But and so it varies. I'd say I feel like the programs that are privatized or run by just entrepreneurs and or socially minded companies tend to succeed a bit more. They're just more nimble ultimately than what government programs can do. They don't end up with like moving forward and then they have to pause because there's a leadership change or something else is taking a priority from a policy perspective, or there's budget cuts, or the MTA is doing something, and so composting takes a backseat. I'd say they've been mildly successful, but ultimately seeing some better success in areas where you see folks kind of just taking up that charge themselves and saying, like, let's get this done. We've seen some really cool programs with folks like doing bicycle collection with compost, like, doing that in through partnerships then with like city parks. So bringing that back into city parks to do some row composting in like the median landscaping. So there's still integration with government programs in that sense. And then with regards to kind of where all of it goes, I don't have a great answer for that, but it varies definitely. And I'm not sure if folks are taking just to kind of like local areas. Like I know here in New York City, we've got like some great rooftop farms, whether it's like Brooklyn Grange or some of the smaller areas, or if they're taking to the more municipal compost facilities.
Yeah. And I know there's, like you said, there's private organizations or companies. My sister actually pays a monthly fee, I think, to have her compost picked up every week and taken somewhere. But again, you know, most people, unfortunately, you know, are not going to spend money to have their compost picked up. But, you know, I know she's really thrilled to be able to do that because she lives in an apartment. She doesn't have a place to put her own compost, and she doesn't want to just throw it out. And I know for myself how much composting reduces my garbage. I mean, I fill up a compost bin almost daily, you know, on my counter and take it out. And I keep putting it into this, you know, compost bin, and the compost bin never really gets totally full because it keeps going down and going down. And then I have this beautiful soil that I add to my garden. And it's like a magical thing watching it happen. You know, it's just, you know, the worms do their thing and
I love it.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a beautiful thing, but I just know if I was throwing that out into my plastic bag that gets picked up every, you know, few days, I'd be adding a lot more garbage. So it feels good to compost. So anyone listening out there, if you're not composting already, that's certainly something that we all can do ourselves. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a place to take it, you know, do a little research. You'll find somewhere, some local farm that would probably be happy to take your compost without having to pay for it. So you might have to drive it there yourself, but, you know, certainly worth doing. I wanted to talk a little bit more about your...
Just one great program to mention in New York is Grow NYC. They do have drop-off zones for compost. Grow NYC is the name. And that's a great opportunity if you kind of have a countertop bin. You might not have someone, you know, picking it up for you, but you can walk to kind of like a neighborhood spot and drop off your compost. And then even like I'm getting a countertop composter soon, and I'm going to go ask my building if they would take my compost and incorporate it into the landscaping. Because I actually don't have a Grow NYC drop off near me. So I was like, someone's landscaping nearby, maybe they'll use it in there. I think that would be perfect.
Well, actually, I have a question. I don't know if you'll know the answer to this, but I was given a composting machine, right? That, you know, I was using last winter because in the winter, it's just so cold to take it out. And I, you know, this turned it into compost overnight. Yeah. But it's electric. And it like takes hours of being plugged in. And I'm wondering, you know, in my head, I'm going, is this really sustainable? You know, how much energy am I using to turn this food into compost? And I don't know if you have any idea on the answer to that, but I wasn't sure. So anyway, I did use it for a little while, but I'm not.
It probably varies by product. They might have done, and you'd really have to dive into like a full life cycle analysis study to understand. And there's probably, it's going to vary by, you know, how much you're using it and all that stuff. So I would always say, you know, check out their website and see if they've done some sort of sustainability study on that. And, you know, even if it's authored by them, it's worth kind of digging into it and seeing, you know, what kind of analysis they've done, if they hired someone to do that sort of LCA study. It is a very good question. And some of those things usually get into like really tiny nuances of what kind of food are you grinding and how hard is it? You know, are you throwing an avocado pit in there? Does it have to grind harder? So.
Right. Now the avocado pits, I actually just throw in the garbage because they never compost.
Yeah.
I end up with these. So I wanted to just talk a little bit more about your roadmap and, you know, what is actually on that roadmap and how are you addressing that roadmap to get to where you want to go?
Yeah. So the roadmap is, so we earlier this year released our insights engine and our roadmap to 2030. And so, and they're kind of a pair of tools. So the insights engine is a set of web-based tools. They're interactive. We'll be updating those annually. So sometime early next year, we'll have a data update for 2022 and 2021. And then the roadmap is almost like an executive summary of all of that data. And it really helps, and it kind of makes parts of it static too, of course. And what it does is it lets people understand if I am a retailer or a policymaker or a restaurant or an investor, what should I be doing? It also helps them understand if I care about climate or if I care about food insecurity, what are some of the solutions I should be working at? So in a slightly more static possibly less overwhelming way, because there is a lot on the insights engine, lets them kind of take a bit of a journey and self-select, even though it's, you know, not, it's on paper, helps them understand, you know, based on my unique situation and what I'm facing in my food waste journey, where should I be going and what should I be working on? So it provides a couple different frameworks in terms of how we're looking at the solutions, how we're looking at these big levers of things like policy, financing, education. And then it really divides things up by stakeholders as well. So you can kind of drill in by those different dimensions and kind of depending on how you want to approach it. Again, whether it's, I really want to go impact first and look at climate, or I really want to focus in on, I'm a retailer and I want to see what's best for retailers and then go into maybe impact or what have you, really just helps people take that journey. And then today, right now, we have folks using the roadmap in very similar ways as they did with our original roadmap, in the sense that they're actually sitting down with it and saying like, all right, this is the update. This is kind of where we're at today and what the solutions are driving us towards, what strategies are available. And based on kind of who we are, where we work in the sector, where should we be spending our time? Where should we be investing our resources? And then we're actually seeing people make those decisions and move forward, which is amazing because that's what we want. Data is cool and fun and we like neat looking web tools, but if it doesn't make people take action, then we haven't done our job.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I know. One of the most painful things at the beginning of the pandemic was seeing, you know, gallons and gallons of milk being dumped into, you know, these bins and, you know, and realizing that change on it, right? We just repackage things and, you know, make the changes quick enough that some changes need to happen for. I don't know where I was going with that, but it's just like, as we were talking about food waste, you know, I was just so moved when I was watching all of that beautiful food being dumped, knowing that there's so many people that are food insecure. You know, does your roadmap have anything to do with, you know, any programs for like gleaning, you know, for helping to get the food off of the farms at the end, you know, towards the end of the growing season? Because I know, you know, working with farmers, that that is such a huge thing. They don't have the infrastructure or the staffing to go and manually pick up all the things that are left in the field. But that's a huge amount of food waste, and that can actually feed people. Anything in your roadmap for that?
Yes. So we do have, so gleaning is one of the solutions that we have in our solution set that we do analysis for and that we promote. And then I'd say there's a couple other ways that we kind of really hone in on kind of like the farmer, the producer side of things. We have a whole section on kind of honing in on producers and what can help producers reduce food waste, whether that's, and just some things are like identifying alternative markets, thinking about secondary resellers, new buyer arrangements, something interesting that, or interesting and pretty innovative that we've seen starting to be talked about in the sector are just different models of contracts and creating more consistency, more security for farmers, better donation channels, as well as enhancing tax credits, because right now it is not even really cost effective necessarily for farmers to be donating, and better data and communication and in terms of a full cycle back to farmers, but also recognizing where that's going to be appropriate and not, because in some places it's useful to say, here's a great technology tool, and sometimes it's just not, and knowing where that's appropriate and just kind of having that awareness. And then we also have kind of, you know, we modeled 42 solutions, but we also broke that down into 7 key action areas just to make it a little more manageable. And our first action area is optimize the harvest. You know, that's where we start with this all, is we're growing this food. We really, like, then we need to optimize that. We need to get it off the farm. We need to get it moving into the supply chain. It needs to be effective. It needs to be efficient. And so whether that's imperfect and surplus produce channels, also thinking about ways that we can be working to better manage buyer spec, as well as consumer preferences for, it's okay if that apple is a little weird shaped, you know, that imperfect produce, and as well as partial order acceptance is another interesting solution. So that kind of weaves into kind of those more dynamic contracting mechanisms. But optimizing the harvest is like the first part of that journey to starting to reduce food waste as it stands on our 7 areas of action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think that would be a biggie. Good. Yeah. You want to share some of the others?
And I'd also just mention we, during COVID, we actually did launch a re-grant fund where we were really fortunate to raise and fully re-grant $3.5 million. And we actually worked with some really great organizations doing gleaning, including Boston Area Gleaners, as well as a technology solution called Forager that helps connect gleaners with farmers. So building capacity for gleaning organizations. So we're very supportive of that work and thinks it's a really big part of the solution. And then, sorry, what was the question?
Awesome. I just wanted to know what the other 7 areas were. Well, that was, that's one. What are the other 6?
Enhanced product distribution. So that's, you know, leveraging technology to create smart systems that help efficiently move products, maximizing freshness. So getting things out as efficiently and effectively as we can. The next is refine product management. So smarter demand planning, better forecasting, things like that. The next is maximize product utilization. So upcycling, manufacturing line optimization. Also, it's not quite the same, but I loved how you were even, when you're doing your recipe, you're talking about how, like, you know, if you don't have, I think it was the scallions, you can, you know, the onion scallion interchange.
Use an onion. Yeah.
Yeah, it was perfect. And having that dynamism. And then the next ones are reshape consumer environments. And this one has quite a few components to it, whether it's portion sizes or package design, as well as consumer education campaigns. You know, that's a huge, broad one. It, you know, includes the work type of work that you're doing here today, as well as like K through 12 campaigns. And then our next two are strengthen food rescue. So donation, education, transportation, improved handling and capacity, value-added processing, as well as better coordination and matching. And you, again, you were doing some of that kind of manually yourself at the beginning. And then the last one is recycle anything remaining. So composting, anaerobic digestion, home composting, community composting, as well as livestock feed. So thinking about, you know, if we can't prevent the food waste, if we can't then capture all of the beautiful, edible, healthy, nutritious food to get to our neighbors, which is the top priority, then let's get it to animals, let's get it back into the soil, let's produce some energy for it, let's just do something else productive with that food and do everything we can to keep it out of the landfill. And get, you know, get some value out of, as you mentioned, all of those incredible resources that we put into it. And we didn't even mention the labor and the love.
Right. Absolutely. The labor is a biggie. Yep. Well, Katie, how lucky are you to be working in such an awesome field and making things happen? Good
Very
for
lucky.
You.
Thank you.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. I can't believe we're out of time. These hours always go so fast. I could talk with you for another hour easily. But I want to thank you and thank you for your work and ReFed. And I will share your information with my network and just thank you. Keep up the good work.
Yeah. Thank you, Bhavani. It's really lovely to be here. Appreciate getting to speak with you and love that you've been covering food waste for a while now. I know you mentioned you had interviewed our executive director back when she was at NRDC. So keep it up. Uh-huh. And we'll love to.
And feedback was another, I think we,
oh,
we
nice.
I met
Wonderful.
Her at a big feedback or event in the city, in Union Square. I think they fed 5,000 people. Yeah. So were you
I
there?
Yeah. We had definitely crossed paths there. That is too funny.
Yeah. Anyway, great work. Everyone out there who's joined us today, I want to thank you for joining us. Do your share, stay involved, and I will see you all again next week. Enjoy your holiday season, and I'll see you next week, and have a great one. Bye for now.